Okay, good. Good afternoon. I don't want to make it so formal, but
let's make it down and let him sit.
Okay. I just want to
introduce.
Okay. I just really want to. I want to thank Larry for hosting the Lunch and Learn, and I want to actually thank also Joey Fried for asking Larry to host the Lunch and Learn. It was actually his idea that we asked Larry, and I want to welcome everybody. Of course, you know, for those who don't live either in the Sher Shemaim area or Chaim area, so this is your only opportunity to hear Mark. It's a pleasure to have him. I see a couple people who will be with us on our trip to Europe, which are still a trip to Europe. And really, as you all know, Mark is really one of the top scholars in the Jewish world, intellectual history, all things relating to the truth in our historical record. So without further ado, I'm going to
let
him take over.
And I'll get right to it. For those who are Torah Moshe people, you might know that I've been speaking now. It's over 4 years, I think. There's over 100 talks online. So one of the things I'm going to speak about now, and I guess I'll speak for maybe 35 minutes or so, and then I think some of the things, the issues I raise, there'll be a lot of comments or questions, so we'll leave some time for that. And the title of the talk is Rabbinic Biographies, because I said that's what I do, not just in writing, but in the talks online. Personal reflections on the balance between reverence and historical truth. And basically I want to talk about, is the feeling of reverence that we're supposed to have towards great rabbis, we call them gedolim, is there a tension between that and the historical portrayal? And what kind of fallout is there when a gadol is humanized? And is this something we need to be concerned with, or should we just tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may? Now, this is a fairly recent sort of question, I think, because biographies of great rabbinic sages have only been coming out in the last 25 years, I think. Not just biographies, I'm talking about even hagiographies. So we have this tension between academic biographies, and I think my biography, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, was maybe the second academic biography. David Ellenson wrote one on Israel Hildesheimer. And at the same time, we have the creation of a whole genre of hagiographies published by Feldheim and Art Scroll and the rest of them. And many of these hagiographies appear in Hebrew as well, and I know people like to make fun of them and say, when I say hagiography, lives of the saints. So the truth is, they are valuable in certain ways. All academic biographers use these. You just have to know how to use them properly, because they have an agenda, an explicit agenda, which is supposed to make the rabbi appear great and all these sorts of things. But you can use them carefully. And the agenda, by the way, is not implicit, it's explicit. So when I say personal reflections, because I want to tell you a bit about my background, tell you a story or two, and you'll see how this plays into the problem I'm going to discuss and how it illuminates the broader issue. First of all, it was two of my publications that brought this issue front and center in the Orthodox world, how to write histories of great rabbinic sages. I wrote a doctorate on Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. Isidore Twersky's department, no one had ever written a biography about a figure who lived so recently. He died in 1966. Now, this was good and bad. It was good in the sense that I was able, I finished in 1995, I was able to interview many students of his, get many letters. They gave me personal letters. I have a collection now of about, I think, close to 600 letters, and I'm still collecting. Just about 2 months ago, someone sent me two letters from Weinberg to Agnon's, not to Agnon, to Bialik. So I'm continuously finding these new letters. So this was advantageous. On the other hand, the disadvantage was that there were many people, students of Yechiel of Weinberg, who had, for example, left the Torim Derech Eretz world, gone to the yeshiva world, and they very much wanted to influence how I would write. They didn't want him to be portrayed as a more modern type of figure. They were uncomfortable with an academic biography. But I have to say at the start that this wasn't the case with all those who we regard as Haredim. Many of them were very helpful and very even praiseworthy after the work appeared. Rabbi Gifter, just to give one example, who's the late Rosh Yeshiva of the Telz Yeshiva, he gave me the letters that he received from Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, the Soloveitchik family in Jerusalem. This is to the right of Agudas Yisrael. I mean, this is almost Eda Haredim. Anti-Aguda, this is the Brisker Rav's family. They... A branch of that family comes from Switzerland. They were very helpful and gave me letters. So this idea that people have that the Haredi world, they're unsophisticated, it's Art Scroll, it's Yatei Nemad, it's only true about a certain segment of it. Let's not forget, Torah study at its highest is conducted in the Haredi world. In fact, most of my every time I publish something on the Sfarim blog, I get more emails from people in places like Kiryat Sefer and Bnei Brak. I mean, the Haredi world. So there is, as I'll speak about in a few minutes, there is an elite intellectual strata in the Haredi world as well that's very comfortable with academic studies of the sort I and others do. That what they're not comfortable with is popularizing this because of their elitist mentality I'll speak about soon, that this is something only for the elites, not for the masses. But they are very much, we've seen the journals Yeshurun and even Chakira has people from that world who write in it and certainly read it. Getting back to the story. So I'm writing this dissertation, and Rabbi Chiyok of Weinberg was very friendly with a man named Samuel Atlas. He's a Sobotka Bacher, becomes a big Talmud Chacham. He published a work which is found in every yeshiva in the world, I would think. The Rivad, Rav Ben David, Apasker's commentary on Baba Kama is published by Samuel Atlas and is used by everyone. The problem, if you can call it that, is that he later left the Orthodox world and he went to teach at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati and later in New York. He was never a German Reformed Jew, but he wasn't an Orthodox Jew. He was somewhere in the middle. He was one of these people, these lost souls, didn't know where to make his place. Weinberg, Yechiyak of Weinberg, was very friendly with him. In fact, in a sense, he was Rabbi Yechiyak of Weinberg's alter ego. Rabbi Weinberg wasn't married, so who's he going to talk about all his problems with? To Samuel Atlas. And he was able to become keep a friendship with him, a very close friendship with him for 30, 40 years. So I wanted to see the letters because I knew they had correspondence. In fact, there's one responsa, in the Sridi Yesh Atlas. And Atlas wrote a nice eulogy of Weinberg, quoted some of his letters. So what to do? Well, I called up his widow. Samuel Atlas died in, forget the year, in the 70s, 75 I think it was. But he had a widow who was still alive. She was younger than him, but she was about 93, 94, I believe. When I called her up, she was listening to Phone Book in Manhattan in 1990 or 1989. And I spoke to her. She told me about Rabbi Chiyok of Weinberg, who she never met, by the way. Her husband would go to Switzerland all the time, you know, once a year to meet him, every other year, but he would constantly go over the 20 years after the war. Weinberg died in 66. She never accompanied him, but she knew a great deal about him through correspondence and the like. She told me that there was a huge... I asked her, where's the letters? Because I'd seen the letters Atlas wrote. Many of them are in an archive. At least I thought I'd seen them all, but I didn't. Many of them are in an archive in Israel, Rabbi Weinberg's archive. She told me that all the letters that Rabbi Weinberg sent to her husband are kept in this restricted, closed collection at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and no one's allowed to see it till after her passing. I think she thought that she didn't know what the letters say. She didn't know Hebrew. She knew Yiddish, but the letters were in Hebrew. She thought it might have personal information. It turns out that it does have personal information, but nothing of a bad sort. They never had children, so there's discussions in the letters about, he writes to Weinberg about they want to adopt one of the Holocaust orphans, things like that. But she said until she passes, no one was permitted to see the letters because she didn't want it, and I think because of personal things. So now I'm going to tell you a story. If I was in a law firm, maybe someone could speak to the ethics of it. Certainly a journalist might appreciate it, but... I'm going to tell you exactly what happened, and maybe some of you will think I did wrong. I don't know. Let me tell you exactly what happened. This material was very important. I knew this was going to be groundbreaking, these letters, because even not having seen them, we don't have any other case in history where we have private correspondence in detail of a Gadol Yisrael, a great rabbinic sage, writing to someone who's no longer in the rabbinic world. We don't have any examples where people bear their soul in this way. The closest thing is perhaps Rabbi Yaakov Emden's autobiography, his memoir, which he talks about all sorts of crazy and strange stuff. And if maybe next year, if we go on our Torah in Motion trip to Alten on Hamburg, we'll talk about Rabbi Yaakov Emden. So I go to the Jewish Theological Seminary. I was living in Boston at the time, but I came down. And I go upstairs, if you know what I'm talking about, the top floor there, they have the rare book room, the manuscript room, and there's no record in the computer, there's no in the card catalog of any Samuel Atlas, Yechiyak of Weinberg collection. So I ask the person in there, the rare book librarian, and he knows nothing about this either, but he calls up Professor Schmelzer, Menachem Schmelzer, who was the librarian for many years, and he knows everything. So Schmelzer tells him that it's in, if you know, the room up there, they call it the Kodesh Kadashim, manuscripts with the Rambam and everything. He tells me exactly where it is. So they bring it out to me. And here's the ethical issue, which I mentioned. that he brings out to me a folder, a manila folder, a thick manila folder, and I sit down. Remember, she told me that he can't be seen until after she passes away. I open it up, and lo and behold, you have a letter there saying that that this is a gift from Mrs. Atlas, but it's not to be seen without her permission. It didn't say after passing. It said without her permission, it's closed. I don't remember the exact wording. It's closed. Certainly, you couldn't make reproductions. You couldn't make copies. You give it to anyone, they'll see that. So was I supposed to close it up and give it back? As I guess you can judge the ethics. As I said, we'll talk later. I, like a good reporter, I read through them. I sat there for a few hours. I read through all the letters and was blown away. The first thing I did when I left the library is call up Mrs. Atlas and tell her, so I guess we could say, sof tov, hakol tov, all's well that ends well. I explained to her that I was in the library. I read the letters. They gave them to me. They did give them to me. They weren't going to copy them, obviously, because if I gave them, they'd see. And she said, well, you know, they weren't supposed to give them out till after my passing, but I explained to her that there was nothing in there negative or anything like that, so she gave me permission. She says, okay, well, then I give you permission if they're important for you. And based upon her permission, the seminary gave me when you apply to use the manuscripts, it gave me the rights to use the letters. In fact, I had exclusive rights. I assume I still do have exclusive rights to use them. And so that's what I meant when I said sof tov hakol tov, that she gave me the permission. And if you've read my book, you know that I use these extensively in Chapter 7. But it's not just I use them for the biography. I put out a translation of a number of these letters in the Torah Umada Journal in 1997. This is a journal published by Yeshiva University. I remember we sent it to J.J. Schachter, the editor, and both of us knew that this was going to be a significant publication because, as I said, the only example where you get the inner thoughts of a great sage writing to someone who's no longer really in the community. Now, I took out all personal comments. That is, if he mentioned an individual, he spoke negatively, which he did about a lot of people, which we thought were not living up to our standards that they should be. It's always the question. I read all these rabbinic biographies, and you look at it, rabbinic correspondence. I probably mean read more rabbinic correspondence than anyone in the world, and they're full of lashon hara. So, of course, you can say, how do these great gedolim write so much lashon hara? But the answer is clear. They don't think it's lashon hara. The Gemara tells us, and all the sources state that we're supposed to expose the hypocrites. You know, if someone is acting like a great sage, but he's really not, that this is supposed to. So therefore, all these rabbis who tell lashon hara, the reason is they don't think that's lashon hara. They think this rabbi, this so-called gadol, is a fraud or a phony, and maybe they don't say it publicly, but they're saying it to their compatriots, their other rabbis, that their colleagues, that this is a phony, and we'll get back to this in a little bit. So I took out all personal comments. With ellipsis, I always put in three dots so people knew that something was taken out. All I had in there was the substantive points, which I'll speak about in a couple of minutes. Now, when the issue appeared, I was living in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is far from any Orthodox center. So, but I get a call from J.J. Schachter. I don't know if he's been to Toronto at all, but he was the editor at the time. He's actually an expert on Yaakov Emden. He told me that YU's going crazy. Well, why is what about this journal that came out? Everyone's going crazy. Why? Well, first of all, some people are saying this never should have been published. These letters are too controversial. Others were saying, at least one was saying, that I had forged these letters, and I had to send copies of the letters that a Gadol Yisrael, a great sage, could never have written this. Now, this was followed by a great back and forth for the next two issues, letters back and forth on the propriety of publishing it from various rabbinic figures, others, a student, as well as J.J. Schachter's very long article, Facing the Truths of History, in which for about 90 pages he's writing about why it was appropriate to publish it. And in the last page he says, but if I made a mistake, I went to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg's grave and I asked Mechila. So the question is, what's more important? Is it the last page or is it the 90 pages? Now, what was the problem with the letters? The great fear among many was that Weinberg's reputation would be hurt, that he would be removed from the canon of Gedolim. And that never happened. And I think for many people, reading the letters and in the biography, which came out shortly after that, gave them a different type of sage, not the cookie-cutter version, one who has imperfections, but who struggles, as we all do, and has strong opinions. In fact, it was the biography that made him a household name in the modern Orthodox world, which that's what I'm most proud about, because he was known before that as a post-type with some interesting ideas, but now he's really a much more of a significant figure, a vital figure in the modern Orthodox world. This is not my goal. My goal was to write the history and let the chips fall where they may. And by way of illustration, let me tell you another story. When I was writing the biography, actually before the biography, I put out a volume of the Hebrew. I was working at the same time, but I put out a volume of Hebrew writings, and then I put out a second volume that came out in 2004. In there, I published Weinberg's wonderful essay on Theodor Herzl, published in 1935. It's a great essay. Someone approached me. I didn't ask him, but he came to give me ideas as to what I should include and what I shouldn't include. And he says, I should not include in the collected writings Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. Remember, I published the first volume on Halakha, and this was going to be, he knew I was going to publish a volume of essays. Rabbi Weinberg wrote many essays. He said, don't include this essay. Rabbi Weinberg today is very respected in the yeshiva world. If the yeshiva world sees this essay on Herzl, that he has such a positive view of Herzl, he sees Herzl as a Baal Tshuva, someone coming back to religion. He didn't come all the way, but coming back, this will hurt his place in the yeshiva world. And he says to me that this should be a value to me, because today, obviously I wouldn't agree to censor it for the reasons he has, but he says, since Rabbi Weinberg is so respected in the yeshiva world, unlike Rabbi Soloveitchik, who's not part of that world at all, but Rabbi Weinberg is in their canon, and he's a liberal element. He's a liberalizing factor. Today, when the yeshiva world is going so far to the right, I should see that as important that Rabbi Weinberg is in the yeshiva world, because he can act as sort of as a break on the yeshiva world becoming so extreme. But if I publish the essay on Herzl and then he's thrown out of the yeshiva world, then they've lost that liberal vision, and I will be responsible for pushing the yeshiva world even more to the extreme. Now, he thought, as I said, that would be a reason for me to censor. Now, my reply to him, which I don't know if he understood, is that, yes, it is important to me, as a more modern type of Orthodox person, that Rabbi Weinberg is in the yeshiva world canon. If only Rabbi Soloveitchik was also there. But what's more important to me is historical truth, and therefore I'm going to publish the essay, which Weinberg himself published twice in Hebrew, once in Hatzofeh, in the 50s, also he translated into Yiddish, and he added on some beautiful passages there about the Israeli soldiers. And if as a result of this he becomes persona non grata in the increasingly extreme Haredi world, then so be it. By the same token, I would publish, if on his deathbed he became a Satmar Chassid and threw out everything he believed his whole life, I would publish that also, because my point as a historian is not to start with a preconceived agenda and then create the facts so that they go along with it. It's to present the facts and my interpretations of them. So let me now return to the basic issue that I began with. Are the critics correct? Are our feelings of reverence negatively affected? Knowing of the truth about Gadolim, knowing their life story, knowing the conflicts and the controversies, the difficult choices they made. In Yatei Ne'aman, their online edition, which is called De'Av Adibur, if you go there, you'll see right in the homepage it says why we censor, our most popular essay. And they explain why they censor. As I said, in the Haredi world, they're upfront about this. There's nothing secret. A former teacher of mine at BMT, but I knew him when I was there. He taught at BMT, though, was the English language editor of Yatei Ne'aman. And he told me personally that his job is just like this is when Pravda still existed. He says, we're like Pravda. They make sure what goes in and what doesn't. So they're totally upfront. And this is what it says. And you can go later today and read it. A related complaint that is sometimes made is that we leave out information. That is true. But the reason is that in our Torah-based scale of values, the harm or embarrassment that can be caused to someone, perhaps a family member or bystander, rates much higher than the needs of the historical record or journalistic objectivity. The problem, however, with this formulation is that the family member might be embarrassed that his parent attended Yeshiva University, as with Shimon Eider, Rabbi Yitzhak Shiner, the Rosh Yeshiva Kamenetz. He's the one responsible for the Slifkin ban. Remember, we have an amazing thing going on in Israel. They have these placards and these bans come out every other week. They ban books and they literally cannot read the book. So, but Rabbi Shiner, he's from Pittsburgh. He went to YC, then it was Yeshiva College. He could read English, so he read it. He said it was dangerous. And based upon him, all these other Gadolim banned it. But again, none of them actually read what they banned. But he went to Yeshiva College. Rabbi Gifter of Tells, he's a Yeshiva College person. Or Rabbi Wachtfogel, the mashgiach in Lakewood. The family might also be embarrassed if people knew that their relative thought highly of Rav Kook. Thus, in the recent edition of the classic yeshiva Sefer Einayim LaMishpat, which is found in every yeshiva, there's a biography there. A whole biography of Rav Yitzchak Arieli, the gadol who wrote this Einayim LaMishpat, such an important sefer, many volumes. And there's no mention in the biography that for many decades, he was the mashkiach ruchani at Yeshivas Merkaz Harav, as well as a great follower of Rav Kook. So with Yateid's formulation, the door has been opened to censor or alter history for any subjective reason. Now, the quote I'm from Yateid also mentioned the harm caused to bystanders as a valid reason for censorship. So, for example, from the Haredi perspective, the bystander might be harmed by seeing that a certain sage, a Gadol Yisrael, thought highly of Zionism. So again, we have a justification of not revealing the truth. So history can therefore be censored, whatever the reason, because the censor will always come up with a reason and his mind is valid. Now, this issue really came to the fore, I'm sure you all know, with the publication of Nassim Kamenetsky's Making of a Gadol. And there's an interview a number of years ago carried out right during the controversy on Torah Motion. You can download the interview. In this book, he provides a realistic portrayal of Gadolim. And he justifies this in the introduction. He speaks about two ways history has been written, the hagiographic way and the realistic way. And he wants to write realistic, talking about who the Gadolim were, what they really were like. Now, we all know that the response to him was quite severe. The book was put in Chayrim. There was one placard that appeared that he should be put in Chayrim, by Reb Michal Lefkowitz. The only conclusion we can draw from this is that the Haredi leadership is not interested in any sort of real history, but rather with inspiring tales. After all, they will argue, what purpose, what Torah purpose does history serve? They will say, and Rabbi Shimon Schwab wrote a whole essay explaining just this point, elaborating on this, that Torah society traditionally has not valued history the way we think of it. Why do we look back to the past? To find inspiration. So we don't need to know the details of disputes and controversies. Rather, we want to tell all the great things about the past. Now, it could be that history has all sorts of valuable points. But in the Haredi world, they don't recognize it that way. They see only the varnished history. And truth be told, the Rambam had the same perspective when it came to history. He thought it was a waste of time. He didn't see any value. It's interesting, by the way, that there was no criticism in the Catholic world with the publication of the letters of Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa wrote letters over many years to her advisor, her spiritual advisor, and in these letters she confessed often that she couldn't feel God's presence, she felt God was distant from her, even in places apparently she didn't really believe in God, or she felt that God was not present, that her prayers were meaningless, that sort of thing. So we see from this that she had very dark times. She said that these letters should be burnt, and yet the church decided, on the contrary, that these letters were too important, and even though Mother Teresa wanted them to be burnt, they needed to be published. Why? Because they needed the masses needed to see that even someone, a saint like Mother Teresa, even her faith was not rock solid. Faith has ups and downs, and there were times that she felt like, that she doesn't feel God's presence, but nevertheless, she didn't give it all up and go to Paris and, just become some modern type of person. No, she remained doing her good work, until she felt that she was able to overcome these things. So they thought that that was valuable for the masses to see. And what was most important was that she lived her life in a saintly fashion, even though her faith had ups and downs. I happen to think that the church's perspective on saintliness is a very realistic one and can give strength to people who are not at the level of saints. Yet I also know that in our world, letters like this would never be published. First of all, they would be burnt. If we found a letter from a little Bishrael saying that. And if they wouldn't be burnt, they'd be kept so that the people could never see them. Because the fact is, if such letters were ever published, this individual would no longer be regarded as a Gadol Yisrael. Because the fiction is that Gadolim are different from the rest of us, because Gadolim have to have rock-solid faith all the time. Unlike Rabbi Weinberg, who wrote about that faith is stormy. It's ups and downs. It's not straight. Religiosity, orthodoxy, is not easy. He writes about his whole essay on this, how orthodoxy is about ups and downs. But we know in our world that the people will be keeping guard, heretic, he's not a true believer, whatever. That's what would happen. Rav Lichtenstein has written about how we have nothing in our literature comparing to St. Augustine's Confessions. we don't have it. You know, a little Bistro will actually write about times maybe he wasn't so religious when he was younger. That's no, we do not have that. And for good or bad, that's the fact. So returning to Kamenetsky, in response to the attacks on him, he made the following very interesting point. He said that his critics were the ones most disrespectful to Gadolim by portraying them in a non-realistic fashion. He writes this in he published a second edition of his book. He also published a whole book, which he only gives out privately to people, called Anatomy of a Ban, which has all the dirt on the controversy and everything. He asked me about, what should he do with this? Should he let it out? I said, give it to the Hebrew University, let it stay there for 25 years, and after 25 years, open it up. But anyone, apparently, who goes to him, he gives a copy of it. And it is incredible to see the double dealings. I mean, this is Dine Nefashot, we say. To put a cherem on someone, to call him everything in the book without even bringing him in to talk about it? Based on, because other people come and say that this book is so dangerous. And it has to be said that of all the Rabbani, only one had the courage to stand up against this attack. His name was Reb Zelig Epstein. Passed away a couple of years ago. Great Rosh Hashiva, grandson of Reb Shimon Shkup in Queens. He wrote a very strong letter to Rav Yashiv, a faxed letter, faxed him a very strong letter saying that this is totally unfair. Everything he's saying is true. But he was the only one who would stand up, because all the second level Gedolim, once the high level Gedolim put him under the ban, who's going to stand up? Rav Zelig Epstein, that time, was in his 90s. He's not looking to become a super god or anything. He's a Rosh Hashiva. He, I guess, felt he could stand up for the truth, but you're the second level, you're going to go against, they'll destroy you. Anyone who would come out in favor of Kamenetsky, I know people privately came out, spoke to him, but to come out publicly, they would destroy them also, because you're... Rav Moshe Sternbach, who's in a completely different world, the Yiddish Haredi, he's the only one in Israel who felt that he could give somewhat of approval to Kamenetsky, because again, he doesn't depend on the Lithuanian Gedolim. But how could Kamenetsky say this? Say that the people attacking him are disrespectful to the Gedolim? They're the ones who publish all the hagiographies. They're the ones who put the Gedolim on such a pedestal. How could they be the ones disrespectful? He reasons as follows. Take Gadol X, for instance. Truth is that Gadol X was a great sage, Torah scholar, but he also had a temper. So Kamenetsky wrote about Gadol X, all of his greatness, and he also wrote about his temper. And in his introduction, he says that he's going to talk about these small flaws because he quotes Rabbi Huttner, he quotes Lubavitcher Rebbe, and others, that you need to have a true understanding of the Gedolim, and this doesn't take away from them. He quotes Hirsch. This just shows who they are. However, the people who oppose him, they don't want everyone else to know that this Gadol had a temper. They feel that to be a Gadol, you can't have a temper. The proof being because they don't want to let anyone know about this, because if you knew about it, you'd think he's not a Gadol. So the only Gadolim they have are the contrived Gadolim. Take this Rabbi X. They regard him as a Gadol, but only because no one can know what he is really like. So in other words, they're not really respecting him, because they don't want people to know who he really was like, because they think if they really knew what he was about, or let's say he supported Zionism, you can't let the people know he was a Zionist, because a real Gadol can't be a Zionist. So therefore you have to cover this up. Well, who is that respectful to the Gadolim? You're not really respecting Rabbi X. You've created a contrived version of Rabbi X. So by Kamenetsky's reasoning, all the people attacking him and talking about how you have to cover these things up, they are the ones disrespecting, because they conclude you can't be a real Gadol if you're a Zionist. This person we know is a Zionist, ergo they do not respect this person. They only respect for political reasons the Gadol they have created, because they feel that his name is valuable. That's his reasoning. Truth is, it's ingenious, but it's incorrect. The reason it's incorrect is because the thing to remember about Haredi society is it operates on different levels. First of all, you have the intellectual censors. They know everything. They read everything. They're well aware. It's like the people, if you read about the censorship of Hillary Clinton's picture, obviously the censors see the picture. They have to know what to censor. So the intellect, they're at the top. And then, of course, you have the masses, the ones, no one, I've never met anyone who thinks that he or her are one of the masses. Everyone assumes that they can, quote, use the phrase from a popular book, they can handle the truth. But the truth is that there is a group of censors that determine who can get the information, who can't. And then, of course, in Haredi society, at the way bottom, you have the women. You have the Haredi men masses and the women, because the women don't study Talmud, so they're at the way bottom. But the intellectuals contrary to what Kamenetsky's implying, they know the truth. They know that these rabbis were Zionists and had flaws, but they don't believe in history. For them, the writing of stories is about hashkafa training. The books they publish is as much about the present, even more about the present than about the past. And therefore, they're using these biographies to put forth an ideology, let's say an anti-Zionist ideology. And therefore, the Gadol was just a means to put forth this. And therefore, if he was a Zionist, we know today know that Zionism is wrong, is dangerous. And therefore, we don't want people to think because this Gadol, it's not that we're afraid they won't respect the Gadol, but that this Gadol thought that Zionism was important, that they can be a Zionist. So therefore, we have to cover it up. So they won't know. It's about the hashkafa. So obviously there's a tension between the academic approach and the Haredi understanding. However, it's not so clear that at all times the fallout is negative. It actually may be a benefit to the Gadol's reputation to know the truth. And for a good exercise in this, let's look back again at the letters of Rabbi Weinberg that so many people didn't want to be published. What were the issues? There were two problems in the letters. Problem number one is that it showed that he had a very close personal relationship with someone who was not in the Orthodox world. A deep friendship. Well, this very information, which some people found very problematic. In fact, I was asked when I published the Hebrew volume, the volume one dealing with Halakha, if I could take out the name of all the letters to Atlas that deal with Torah things. But this information, which some people found so problematic, in our circles, I would say, is on the contrary. It's not lignai, it's lishvach. It's positive. It's nice to see that you can have a Gadol Yisrael who, although his viewpoints, ideological, are different than his correspondent, he can still relate to him in a personal way, even as a friend, a dear friend. Rabbi Soloveitchik had the same sort of relationship with Rabbi Joseph Shulow in Boston. Conservative rabbi. Rabbi, by the way, when all the Orthodox rabbis, including some names that maybe some of you know, great rabbinic figures, were going after Rabbi Soloveitchik about the kashrus stuff. Got to the point where maybe he could have even brought up on charges, put in jail perhaps. Rabbi Shubo, the conservative rabbi, stood up for him and wrote publicly about this. And Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Shubo then had a very deep friendship. If you look in Rabbi Helfgott's volume he published, Letters of Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have a very interesting letter there, Rabbi Soloveitchik responding to Rabbi Shubo's synagogue, why, although how much admiration he has for Rabbi Shubo, he can't attend the consecration of the synagogue or the consecration of the rabbi, the event honoring the rabbi's service in the sanctuary. You see, the Rav was torn because he very much had admiration, but he couldn't show some approval of a conservative synagogue or Dr. Belkin in Providence, very friendly with the Reform Rabbi Browdy. So this idea that a Gadol Yisrael, and in this community itself, Rabbi, I know that Rabbi Felder had relationships with all sorts of rabbis. He had Torah study with them. This idea that a great sage, although strong in his own views, could be personally friendly and even in Torah matters with others, that is something I would think many people would view as positive. The second issue was what the letter said. In a few of the letters, Rabbi Weinberg expressed difficulty, I guess that's the best word, disappointment with the way Jewish law has been decided in certain areas, in particular Jewish-Gentile relations. He doesn't throw out the law. He's not a conservative rabbi. In conservative Judaism legal theory, you have conscience. You can fall back on conscience, and conscience can even trump black letter law. No. The Orthodox post-sake has to assume that you try to get out of it if you can, but sometimes you just have to accept that this is the halacha. Rabbi Weinberg wasn't rejecting halacha, but he was acknowledging that in certain areas it troubled him. He wished the Shulchan Aruch would have decided differently in some of these areas. Because there were sources, there were Rishonim, but since the Shulchan Aruch didn't, we're stuck with this. So some people thought this is incredible, this is impossible, and you can't show people this, that a posek is saying that certain halachot he's troubled by. On the contrary, though, you can see this as a very positive thing, that someone is willing, as Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the term surrender, he's willing to accept the halacha even if he's troubled by it. You could say that this is even the height of emunah, the height of faith. He admits the certain halachot trouble him. In fact, David Berger has written how he views it as very important that these letters were published precisely because of this point, that even Gadol Yisrael could have these issues. He says, quote, "It's for this reason that I welcomed the controversial publication of Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg's letters expressing his distress over some of these texts. That very distress is Torah, v'lilmod on etzrichim. Rabbi Weinberg has taught us that we are indeed permitted to agonize over these questions. that we are not defying God's will by doing so. And this is not, as a Talmud Chacham told me about a related matter, prikat ol, throwing off the yoke. These letters actually have halachic significance also, because Rabbi Weinberg says we need to accept the opinion of a Meiri, the 13th century Provençal sage, that all the negative comments about Gentiles only refer to the wicked Gentiles of old, the pagans, not the ones we live among. By the way, Rabbi Weingart, the student, the last student of Rabbi Weinberg, his reason for opposing the letter's publication, and he wrote one of the letters in the Torah Ramada Journal, was for a different reason entirely. He thought, and he told me this personally, that Rabbi Weinberg's criticisms of the Haredi world were too strong. Not too strong to have in a book. In a book, you need to discuss it. But when you take all of Weinberg's letters to Atlas and you just pull out the negative comments, you put them back to back, it gives you a false impression that he was fixated on this, which wasn't the case. So I understand his point, and maybe that could have been put into more context. The thing is, if you look at the letters, Weinberg saw 30 years before anyone else what was happening, or 20 years before anyone else, what was happening in the Orthodox world. He saw what was developing in the Haredi world before anyone else. The fraudulence, he spoke about that. If you join Agudas Yisroel, anyone who joins Aguda, they turn into a Gadol Ador. But others, if you're not an Aguda, then you're not important. I mean, he saw the extremism developing, and that's why you have the criticism there in the Haredi world. So Rabbi Weingart thought that this is a violation of Weinberg's privacy to publish these. But that's maybe not true either. Rabbi Alfred Cohen publishes the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. He wrote an essay, and he reflected on this very question, referring to the Weinberg letters that I published. And he calls attention to two amazing stories in the Talmud, where students follow. One student follows his Rebbe into the bathroom, see what he's doing. Another follows him into the marriage room, sleeping under the, going under the bed. And they're discovered, and they're like, what, can you imagine today if you did this to a Rebbe? So the Rebbe looks at him, what are you doing down there? You go, under the bed? And the answer is, this too is Torah, and I need to learn. You know, so obviously they took it too far, but I mean, the idea was that, you know, everything the great sage does is Torah. Rabbi Cohen says, based on these stories, there's no censure of the students in these stories. The Rebbe understands, okay. Rabbi Cohen says, quote, both these incidents, recorded without any censure, illustrate that in the protocol of the Talmud, a rabbinic teacher cannot really have a private life. A person who holds a prominent position in society or the community is in some ways not entitled to enjoy the same level of protection of privacy as, quote, ordinary individuals. He adds that if you have a private letter that maybe just talks about a certain family type of thing, you know, which has no benefit to know, okay, that you don't need to publish. And maybe these are the sort of things where you'd say don't publish them for 75 years. You know, today, if we find a letter from the Rambam, no matter what it deals with, we want to publish it. But if he's criticizing his brother-in-law while he's alive, okay, and even libraries sometimes keep things sealed for 100 years. But if it relates to Judaism, you know, before I published these letters of Rabbi Weinberg, I went to Schneer Lyman, someone I respect a great deal. He said to me, we don't censor the words of Gadol Yisrael. If Rabbi Weinberg in a letter is talking about substantive matters of Judaism, we don't censor it. You know, the dispute was often portrayed about publishing without getting permission, or this or that. The truth of the matter is that was nonsense, and everyone knew it was nonsense. Every week, Torah journals are published with letters of great sages who are dead 50 years, 100 years. Often they've criticized Mizrahi, and no one cares. It's only when you have a great sage who's criticizing the other side, then all of a sudden everyone's so concerned. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip some of what I've been writing about in the Sfarim blog about controversial matters. Rav Kook and others are recently being published, a bit of a controversy. Let me just say, though, that this issue of how to portray Gedolim is not completely new. It goes back, I think, to the Talmud. Rav Aaron Cutler has a famous essay, How to Teach Torah, in which he talks about that when you teach about the sages, about the patriarchs and the biblical figures, you need to portray them as almost these superhuman figures. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Hirsch, had a different approach. And he explains that we need to portray them in a more realistic fashion. Therefore, he criticizes, let's say, Yitzhak for not seeing that every child needs to be raised in this particular fashion. So instead, he raised Yaakov the same as Esav. He thinks that this is a Torah message, that we're supposed to derive things like this from the Torah. This is a great dispute, how to portray great figures. And it even goes back, as I said, to the Talmud. What do I mean by this? Well, you have plenty of examples in the Talmud, for example. Think Esav. Esav, you read the Peshad and the Chumash, he doesn't seem like such a bad figure. he doesn't have the best wives, maybe, but not. But if you then look at how Chazal portray him, he's evil, he's wicked. I mean, they are portraying him much worse than he appears. In fact, after you read it, you get the sense that you're really not reading about Esav the person anymore. You're reading about the archetype of evil. You're reading about Edom. Edom is Rome, and later the church. Same with Bilam. Bilam, again, he doesn't seem so bad from the text, but if you start looking through the Midrash, he's portrayed in every negative way, including bestiality with his donkey. And again, when you read these Midrash, you ask yourself, are you reading about Bilam the individual or Bilam the concept? And it's the other way as well. Positive. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chaya speaks about this, how the approach of certain sages was to take a figure who's ambiguous, who they assume is bad, and make him a lot worse, and do the same with a figure who is maybe not so, doesn't appear so great in the text, and make him a lot better. Think of how David's actions with Uriah the Hittite or Reuven, how they're justified midrashically. So we see from this that it would seem that Chazal had the approach of, the hagiographies. Try to make everyone look good if they're a tzaddik. Try to make people look even worse if they're a Russia. But not necessarily. We have plenty of examples the other way also, where in the text there doesn't seem to be anything wrong, and yet Chazal, because of the way they read the text, they point out things. The Mekoshe Tetzim, the gatherer of the sticks, this is the student of Talmud. Someone says, this is Slavkot's father. How can you say this? The other person said, it's not in the text. It's Lashayrati. This is what he thought Peshat was. And this is the truth. So he says it. Yosef goes in to do his work. Pretty innocuous when he's at the house of Potiphar. One sage says that this means it's a euphemism to do his work. He goes into sin. He thought that was the pshat, and the Torah wants us to know this. How can he say this? Isn't this the sort of thing that should be covered up? A hagiography? So I think we see that even among Chazal, you had those who had the hagiographic perspective, and those who said, no, we have to tell the truth. Whatever the truth is, this is what the Torah wants us to know. Why the Torah doesn't say it explicitly? Because maybe the children shouldn't know this, or the ignorant. But when you reach a certain level, this is what we need to know. Let us now then, and to conclude, return to the issue of biography and the tension between reverence and historical truth. I don't deny that the tension exists. And I assume that some people are hurt by seeing the realistic picture which I draw with other people draw. And this is not something to be treated lightly. Rav Kook says that even if you know something's true, you don't tell people it if you think it's going to hurt their faith. You don't go into Meir Shari maybe and start speaking about how Darwin and Torah could be reconciled. They never heard of Darwin. So there is this sense of elitism and that you don't need to expose everyone to every truth. And I actually believe this. Some of you might disagree. Once after I gave a talk, I even think it was in Toronto, someone came up to me and said his son is becoming a Chabadnik, and he had been reading recently. This is when the book came out. David Asaf talked about how Rav Shneur Zalman's son became an apostate to Christianity. Moshe, it turns out he was a bit crazy, this Moshe. He wanted to know if he should tell his son about this as a way of maybe destroying his love affair with Chabad that everyone... Truth, I don't think this hurts. Real Chabadnikim intellectuals, they know the story. But I said to him, what do you need to do this for? If you're your son's happy in his lifestyle. So, in a sense, I appreciate that. But I would also say that for many, humanizing a gadol can also be a benefit to his reputation. I find that intellectually sophisticated people are not moved by hagiography. A true life story of a gadol should be able to provide inspiration. And if it doesn't, then maybe he's not really a gadol. I mean, and people today, we read sophisticated biographies of John Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln. People who read sophisticated biographies of political figures, they certainly want the same of their religious figures. And I've been told that not just my book was inspiring, although that's not why I wrote it, but people found it religiously inspiring, but Kamenetsky's book was inspiring religiously. But let me make something clear. As I said, I didn't write it for that reason. I'm not a, quote, orthodox historian in the sense that I know the answers ahead of time and I just had to get there. Yaakov Katz in his autobiography describes this when he was already a student in Frankfurt. He gave a talk and someone said, well, that's really not, the traditional way. He says, that's because history, you can't put history, quote, orthodox in that sense, in that you know at the end where you're going to get to and it's just how you get to there. And this will lead to problems. There's no question. But the fact that my books have sold and people are interested shows that the Orthodox world has many, even in the Haredi world, who are interested in real history. But I fully admit that real history can sometimes be destructive of reverence. But, now let me say the but. the fact that certain people might come away with a negative view of certain rabbis, seeing that they were involved in disputes and things like that, I'm not convinced that that's a bad thing at all. We're not the Catholic Church. Catholic Church, if you're in a parish, you're told who your priest is. You're told who your bishop is. The lay people have no say at all. In our communities, we determine, we choose our rabbis, our local rabbis, we choose our Gedolei Yisrael, our great sages. In the famous New York Times interview with Ramosha Feinstein, he's asked, what made you such a great religious authority? He said, well, people asked me some questions, they liked the answers, so more people started asking. But we choose, and our decisions in these areas should be informed decisions. If it turns out that someone we regard as a religious leader has some terrible flaws, well, then maybe these are the sorts of things that need to be made public so that people can decide, is this person the sort of person we want to look up to as a gadol? Maybe he's been protecting sexual child abusers. Well, the fact that he knows a lot of Torah, that's neither here nor there, because I don't think anyone would agree. I think all of us would agree that someone who knows a lot of Torah, who's facilitating sexual abuse, he's not a gadol. So these are the sorts of things that need to be made public. And to the cries of Kavod HaTorah, Kavod HaTorah would require you to expose the hypocrites because he's really not a Gadol Yisrael. I've never written about this, by the way, in any of my books, but on the Sfarim blog I wrote about a 19th century Gadol Yisrael who forged a medieval text, attributed to one of the Rishonim. And, we have stories like this, and this doesn't mean that there's no concern with Kavod HaTorah, respect for Torah, or with Lashon Hara. On the contrary, I think you need to have these concerns, but there needs to be a balance. I actually think the Kamenetsky book was a little too voyeuristic, incidentally, in that area. And I'm sure there'll be at times where it's going to be hard to tread. The story of a famous Rosh Yeshiva who was involved in a hijacking. And his behavior on the airplane, this is in the 70s, it's very questionable. He separated himself from it. He got his family was there to convince the hijackers he's special. And he should be separated, and he wasn't with the Amcha, he was in front, and his students in America thought they could raise money and ransom him. I mean, the whole thing's crazy. How you can ransom, you can't negotiate with terrorists, this is a government, you're not individuals, you go to the tarmac. But they asked Rav Kamenetsky, and he said, no, you don't negotiate and get one Jew out as opposed to another. But people wrote about this afterwards, people who were on the hijacking. And I'm not judging anyone at all. This is very similar to the case when rabbis left Germany or left Europe. Who's to say that it's not everyone for themselves? You have plenty of rabbis who left Europe. They saved their lives. And you have plenty of rabbis who stayed with their communities. Ramosha Feinstein writes, he told about how he was worried when he came to America. People would say he abandoned his community in the Soviet Union. So, I'm not saying one way is correct and one way is not. But to write a biography of this rabbi, you'd have to deal with this issue. And if I don't know how it's going to conclude, I feel it's okay for me as a historian to say, I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to write about that because I don't want to maybe be in the position of having to conclude that what he did was terrible. I don't consider that censorship because I can choose what I'm going to write about. Of course, if I decide to write a biography of this rabbi, then I can't leave it out. There's a gadol, level 2 gadol, not level 1, second level. He fathered a child. When he was in the yeshiva, he was 17 or 18. He had a child out of wedlock. I'm assuming it's true because Haaretz published all the documentation about 20 years ago. I don't think that there's any reason to reveal this sort of thing. Even great figures, even celebrities, I believe, have a private life. And I don't consider this censorship. If I knew, I'm not going to tell you who this person is. If you know who it is, fine. But I would never write about this. I don't feel it's important. On the other hand, if it so happened that this sage, it turns out that he had this child and he abandoned this child and wanted nothing to do with it or something else, then I would feel it's important because it says something about his character. But if it was a youthful indiscretion and the child was put up for adoption and then he's lived the rest of his 50 years of his life, we need to bring this up. I mean, I think that's a terrible invasion of privacy. I think what Haaretz did is a terrible invasion of privacy. Because there's people have a right to a private life. Even Rabbi Cohen, who said that gadolim don't have a private life, we're talking about something when he was 17 or 18 years old. He wasn't a gadol then, and I don't consider this to be censorship. On the other hand, I can't write a biography then about this rabbi, because how can you leave out this element? Having a child is the most important thing in people's lives. I don't feel I can write a real biography of this. So therefore, I wouldn't write a biography. And I feel that that's an okay choice, that this is not censorship. I can choose who to write about and who not to write about. And since I would not want to reveal such a thing, and since if I wrote about it, I'd have to reveal it, otherwise it's not an honest biography, I choose not to. That's my choice. And it could be, as I said, that these sorts of things could be revealed in the future, but not at present. So in summation, let me therefore say that real history is not for everyone. I don't think it's necessarily what we need to teach children. I mean, in America, many of you are probably from America, you know, when you're a child, you learn that Abraham Lincoln fought the Civil War to free the slaves. And then when you get to college, you study history, you know that that's not why the Civil War was fought. It was about the, they were actually slave states that were fighting on the Union side, Maryland, Kentucky, if I'm not mistaken. It was more complicated than that. But you understand that you teach children one thing, and then they get older, they get a more sophisticated understanding. So I think the same thing is with history. Although on the Torah in Motion talks that we do on Monday night, we try to do real history because we assume that everyone tuning in is sophisticated and are interested in the truth. And I do believe that in the more modern communities, serious portrayals are requirements for people with advanced secular education. And it's not just an intellectual requirement. I think it's an ideological and in many cases even a spiritual requirement. So with that, I see I've gone over a bit, but I'll end. And if we have time, maybe for a couple questions or comments. I know I've spoken fast and said a lot of provocative things, perhaps. But, yeah. Yeah, that's I quoted Rabbi Lichtenstein as saying that. Rabbi Yaakov Emden's biography is basically what I would say to Rav Lichtenstein. I don't know if Rav Lichtenstein's ever read Yaakov Emden. I'm sure he has heard of it. And knows in generalities what it's about. That is an example. That is a parallel. Yaakov Emden speaks about all sorts of things, about how his cousin tried to seduce him and all. I mean, all sorts of crazy stuff and all the rabbis who he hates. The difference is that that's not a spiritual autobiography. That's an autobiography in which he wants to basically take his revenge against all his, not just his enemies, his father's enemies. He wants to talk about his life a bit. It's not a spiritual biography in the sense that Augustine speaks about growing from his wicked youth and growing up into becoming a God-fearing person. It would be as if we had a Baal Tshuva who became a Gadol and wrote about, not just in generalities, really wrote about what it meant to be irreligious. And that, I think, we could have, because today in America, even in the world, it's no longer regarded as a shame to be a Baal Tshuva. What we couldn't have is, I don't think you could have someone who grew up irreligious, who grew up religious, became irreligious, let's say, for 10 years, and then came back. Such a person, I don't know if he would be recognized as a Gadol Yisrael. There is one, incidentally, another great rabbi who supposedly, at a certain time of his life, gave it all up. But we could not have that, I don't think. So we don't have a spiritual autobiography. We don't have many autobiographies, but Yaakov Emden is the closest we have to a scandalous autobiography. Jacob Schachter is, J.J. Schachter apparently is publishing this in Hebrew version. He's working on it for 30 years. He was going to publish the English one, but I think he's backed out of that because he thought it would be too... No, that's a censored version. There's two publications which are censored and all sorts of problems. And even with the censorship, there's all sorts of stuff in it. But a complete uncensored. If anyone's interested, J.J. Schachter's dissertation, I can send anyone a PDF. It's maybe the longest Harvard dissertation ever of almost 800 pages, if I recall. And he discusses everything in great detail. The Haredi world is very opposed to publishing the autobiography, even though Rebecca Vemden wrote it, because they feel, you know, we should know this material about him, about others. Yeah. But he thought you should know it. Yeah.
Well, I must have gone to the wrong university because I didn't know that about the slaves and the Canadian university.
Yeah.
So I think you have to admit to a certain extent that history or historians are not really objective. Their perspective is colored by their political, economic, religious, national experiences, even their personal experiences. And at least in defense of Haredim, they have the honesty of admitting that they are giving you a certain version.
Sure. And that, I have another talk where I speak about this, talk of precise censorship. Obviously, historians are influenced in ways, certainly unconsciously. Everyone's influenced. And as you point out correctly, in the Haredi world, they're conscious. However, a historian tries to the best of his ability to over overcome these, and the historian, the honest historian, won't intentionally censor material for ideological reasons. So you have two different perspectives. The Haredi perspective on history is actually the traditional perspective. I mean, if you read Josephus, for example, that's not history the way we do it. I mean, he makes up this whole speech that Elazar gives on the mountain. I mean, history used to be a form of trying to glorify your kingdoms. Even the Book of Chronicles, in the commentary there attributed to Rashi, it's not Rashi, but it's a Rishon attributed to Rashi, he says that this book is written to portray David in a certain way. So history used to be written with an agenda. It's only the last few hundred years that people like in the universities, like me, that we try to write a so-called objective history, even though, of course, it's not objective, but we try to actually work at history. But the Art Scroll way is they're just continuing an old tradition of history as the handmaiden of ideology. That's just a different perspective on history. Of course, if they come into my communities and try to say things that are false and phony, I think it's important to point out that this is false and phony. But from my perspective, in their communities, if this is how they want to portray it, I have no objection to that. If you can listen to our motion, I remember a few years ago we had Daniel Sperber and Slifkin and me, and I was actually the retrograde one defending the Haredim, that if they want to live this way, it's fine. And they were the paternalists, that no, we need to go into the Haredi world and educate them and bring them these things. And I'm a live and let live type of person, and as the Rambam was.
Is it all that different from the biographies that are done in sports legends, for example?
No, I think it's similar to that, I guess, where they present their well, it depends on the biographies. You have the authorized biography versus the unauthorized. You have biographies which are done with the sports star. It's like, the sports star as told to so-and-so. That's different than a critical biography, which would talk about Mickey Mantle, all his foibles and everything. That would be an authentic biography. But then you have the other type. Different strokes for different folks. But I think you can appreciate why the academic biographies would be problematic in certain communities, because after all, it's destructive of a view of Das Torah, in which everything has one perspective. Like, take Rabbi Soloveitchik. In the Haredi world, he's recognized as a great Torah scholar, but not a gadol. Now, why not? He knew as much as these others. He knew more than them. And they know, they'll tell you he knew more, but he's not a gadol, because to become a gadol, the difference between a Torah scholar and a gadol is a gadol has to hold by the Das Torah. The gadol has to hold by the perspective established by the Haredi sages of a previous generation, like the Chazon Ish, for example. So if you break with that and you become a Zionist, you're a Torah sage, but by definition not a Gadol. You can see in Yatei Neman the Hebrew who's a Gadol. Who gets the titles Maran, Harav HaGaon, and who just gets Rabbi? Rav Avadya Yosef used to be a Gadol in Yatei Neman. First he wasn't, then he was, and now he's not again. And hashkafa is the most important thing there. So that's, in a society that believes in this, and it's very important value, you can't have this information is destructive. And I understand that, and I appreciate that. But it's only for the masses in the Haredi world. That's why I think a lot of people not in the Haredi world don't understand. The intellectuals, they all know all this, and they write about this. If you read Yeshur and the others, they write about all these machlokas and the Zionism and not. But in the popular books, like the Art Scroll types, that's where you won't get it. Because they make a distinction between popular education and the elites. Yeah, you want to say?
The question on objectivity of history, would you say it's akin to the objectivity of halakha? The law will say that the halakhic man is totally objective.
Yeah.
And
the Rav knew it's impossible. He halakhic man, he says at the beginning, it's sort of like economic man. It's not real life. It's I'm not going to use the word caricature. He says that it's a creation. It's like a Platonic creation. Because if you look, for example, in the books published by Rabbi Helfgott, he has his letter there. He has two letters, but one in particular, he was asked about being chaplain, Orthodox Jews being chaplain in the army. And he says right at the beginning that I could not imagine ever concluding that this was forbidden. And therefore, I tell you right up front that I come with certain values that are being brought to bear. No different, I would say, than when a post-psych looks at an aguna question, for example. He's not objective. He starts with the assumption that I'm going to free this woman or free the mamzer. It could happen that maybe he's not able to, and then you just got to throw up your hands. But odds are you're going to be because you're going in a certain direction. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says, when he's talking real halacha, lemaisa, he says that we're not objective. And we come with these preconceptions and these values that push us in a certain way. And yes, I would say it's very similar. Everyone is influenced. Historians would be the first to say that we're influenced, and it's often only others who can point out your flaws. And I shouldn't say flaws, your biases, because you don't see the biases. You try to overcome it the best you can, but you're never able to, and that's why we need other people. The whole idea of historical insight is that we can see things better than people who lived at a previous generation. We see things. So they'll point out my biases, I'll point out other biases, and that's fine. And we have to recognize that. No one is objective, and no posek is objective. It's not an accident that an anti-Zionist posek will never conclude, just from reading the sources, that, hey, you know something? The Hetter Mechira is good. And that you say, how long is food? And the opposite will never happen. It's just impossible. And that's okay, because you start with certain assumptions hashkafically, and that influences the way you look at halakha. The problem, I would say, in the Haredi world, and I say this knowing that the Haredi world has many advantages that the modern world does not have. A Torah study, for example, is just one of them. You know, that's why I am so involved in the Haredi world, because precisely the issues I write about, the stuff, the Haredi world, that's where you get the top Torah scholars. I like to have interaction, so the modern Orthodox world doesn't come anywhere near the Haredi world in terms of Torah study, in terms of respect for great sages. On the other hand, one of the problems, the flaws, I think the fatal flaw of the Haredi world, is its lack of respect, its refusal to recognize 70 Shivim Panim Torah, or at the very least 3 or 4 different perspectives, and its refusal to recognize that there's always been an agadic tradition that has different gedolim with different perspectives. You have Rav Herschel Schechter with one way, you have Rav Yoshev with another, different perspectives, all recognizing halacha, but on ideological matters. And I do have to blame the Haredi world for this, because in Europe, for example, you never had this. In Europe, you had a Rav of a city. If he was a Guda Rav, he decided halacha, everyone went to him with the chicken, and he was the Rav. If he was a Mizrahi Rav, and many Rabbonim in Europe were Mizrahi, he was the Rav, he was the posek. Everyone went to him, the Aguda people in town. When it came to, they differed ideologically, but when it came to halacha l'maisa, if you can do this on Shabbos, they went to the Rav. It's the Haredim who created this new idea that if you're not, you don't have Haredi perspective on Das Torah, you're not a reliable posek, and therefore you can be in a community, and because you have a Rav there who's, let's say, a Tzioni or half Tzioni, if he doesn't follow it, so therefore we're going to ask our Rosh Hashiva, or we're going to create our own shtiebel with our own Rav. No, in Europe, every town had one shul, and everyone went, and everyone followed it, and the Beistin in Vilna, you know who Rav Chaim Ozer picked as his dying number two? A Mizrahi, the Marcheshes, the Chaim Chagas. So that, I think, is the flaw in the Haredi world, that they created this problem now where we can't have Rabbanim unless they fall into the certain Hashkafa. And that's mixing, the Chasam Sofer would use the expression, mixing Kilayim. You have Hashkafa, Lachud, you have Halacha. Someone could be a great Posek, but if he's the Posek, you don't have to agree with him Hashkafically. But in the Haredi world, you have to agree Hashkafically with the Posek. And therefore, so that, I think, as I said, I could tell you all the many positive things of the Haredi world and all the problems in the modern world, if you're interested. But this is one of the problems. This is one of the areas, I think, where the modern world, they are able to get Torah from everyone. They don't have this litmus test. So I think that's a big strength in the modern world. So everyone has their strengths and everyone has their weaknesses, at least from my perspective. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. The topic tonight is, was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik a Zionist? That's the topic. I don't know if the B'nai Akiva people will like it so much, but again, we have to speak the truth. And the Rambam and superstition. Obviously, the Rav was a Zionist, but the question is different, very, very different type of Zionist, and certainly different than what I was taught growing up and what I know they teach at Or Chaim. So if you want to get really upset at the Rav, come to the talk. Well, yeah, I mean, the idea that Jews, the place for Jews is in the land of Israel, which is basic to early Zionism, the Rav rejects that entirely. Yes, that's true, when his students, and they made Kiddush. When they went to Eretz Yisrael, they sponsored Kiddush, and when the Rav became a citizen, he and his wife sponsored Kiddush. But yes, it's complicated about the Rav, and you turn it off. Yeah, it's complicated about the Rav and Aliyah, because he didn't want to...